Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. How's everything going, everyone? This show is brought to you by Airdrop. Airdrop is a new section on Crate Club where you can find essential gear and killer apparel that you can buy separately from our monthly and quarterly club subscriptions. There's some great stuff on there that's heavily discounted, but a lot of these items sell out quick, like that tactical pen. Those are gone. So you really got to act now. For example, we've got a few more Crate Club custom NFW watches left, Cry Precision Ballistic Soft Armor inserts, and those cool Crate Club fishing spears. It's up on its own section on crateclub.us, the store tab, or you can go to store.crateclub.us, and it's all right there to check out. That's store.crateclub.us. Tons of gear you're going to love right there on Airdrop. I'm Ian Scotto. It's just me this episode with our guest, of course, Richard Jellerson. But Jack is out. He'll be back hopefully next episode. I just know he's not doing great at the moment, but he should be back in action in just a couple of days. I know he's excited for this interview, but this should be a good one regardless. Richard's story is a really interesting one. So, yeah, nothing really going on that I need to update you guys on over the last few days. I did watch... Some of you are going to laugh. I did watch In the Army Now with Pauly Shore and Andy Dick. And I love Pauly Shore's work. I wasn't sure if I've ever seen this before. It's on Netflix if you want to watch it. I've heard of it, and I remember it coming out and all that in the 90s, but I'm not sure if I ever watched it. If I did, it's been so long that I forgot. And I laughed my balls off. It is a hilarious movie. And it's probably the only military movie that's dedicated to the Army Reserve. So I don't know. I mean, there might be. I'm not a movie guy, so there might be another movie with the Army Reserve. But I mean, I feel like you have to do comedy on that one. You know, just because of the nature of it, you're kind of going to downplay what those guys do and make it funny, and they did. And I do recommend you check it out. There could be other Army Reserve movies. I really don't know. If you do, you could feel free to tweet me at Ian Scotto. But In the Army Now is highly recommended. So because of that, I was on a whole Pauly Shore kick after that, and I watched the documentary that he has, which is up on Amazon Prime, and it's called Pauly Shore Stands Alone. And it's really very much about like the unglamorous life of being a stand-up comedian at his level. So he's playing in middle America at these places that aren't even necessarily comedy venues. And he does pack them out. See, it's an interesting thing. I've noticed this when I go to shows outside of New York in like the Pennsylvania area compared to New York. In New York City, in order to like sell out a venue of any type, you have to be A-list because there's always something going on. But if you go to rural America somewhere, you could sell out, you know, hundreds of seats, which he does, which you'll see in the documentary. And it reminds me, I'm a huge fan of the band Dope. I saw Dope play the Croc Rock in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is no longer there. And it was packed, absolutely packed, all these people there to see them. And I think part of it goes to that there's probably just not as much to do in Allentown, Pennsylvania, to be completely honest. And just a few months later, I saw them play Webster Hall, the Marlin Room in New York City, and it was literally maybe 12 people there. And Edsel Dope even commented that he was like, we're having a good time, but this is kind of pathetic. Maybe you guys could tell a friend to come next time that we play here. So I thought the documentary played into that whole world of if you're playing somewhere in Nebraska, you could sell it out. And Paulie Shore does play those local Los Angeles venues and at times comes to New York City. But in order to like really pack out a crowd, he has to go to these middle America venues where he's very much celebrated. And in these very small towns where there's not a whole lot to do. So it was interesting. I watched that last night. It's Paulie Shore Stands Alone. But with that, I'm going to get over to Richard Jellison, who did a documentary that's of much greater importance, to be honest, called A Solemn Promise, America's Missing in Action, about our men missing in action. 82,000 of them, which I was unaware of that statistic. And this guy's military career and also just what he's done since is pretty incredible. So, yeah, I'm going to get right over to Richard Jellison and hope you guys enjoy. So as promised, for the first time on the podcast, Richard Jellison, Army helicopter pilot and Vietnam veteran who served with the 116th Assault Helicopter Company in his first tour, and then his second Vietnam tour as General Abrams' personal pilot. He's the author of Pan Am Flight 001, about the round world flight he took before returning home on his second tour of duty, and the director of A Solemn Promise, America's Missing in Action, as well as several other films which we could talk about. And we'll get into all of it. A Solemn Promise is available at storytellerfilms.tv. And I originally was made aware of you, Richard, through our past guest, Mark Yablanka. So how do you guys know each other?
You know, I was introduced to him by a couple of mutual friends, and he was on the advisory board for that film and has been a huge help in mentoring me through the process of writing my first book. So he is a good guy and a good author, good books.
Yep, Vietnam Bao Chi, which we recommend everybody picks up. So I think before we even get into this great film about America's MIA, as well as your book, it'd be interesting to get into your background in Vietnam and serving as an Army helicopter pilot. People would probably love to hear about someone who served as an assault helicopter pilot during that time. So, yeah, I'd love to get into your backstory.
The interesting thing about, I did a film for the History Channel called Helicopter Warfare in Vietnam.
Yes, I was going to mention that among like several other films. I have them all listed here, which people can see on the website, but yeah.
Yeah, and what I did, I interviewed a lot of air crew members, crew chiefs, door gunners, pilots. And the interesting thing about the pilots is they had the same story as I did. Was not doing well in college, having way too much fun, knew I was going to get drafted, but always wanted to learn how to fly. So, and the Army had a need for helicopter pilots at that point. So I got accepted and trained, and knowing that at the end of the year of flight school that I was going to be going to Vietnam, and did end up at the 116th, which was an assault helicopter company, which means we picked up troops and inserted them into combat situations and went back to pick them up and move them to a different area, and a lot of medevac missions, a lot of medevacs. even though there were medevac units, we were already there, already in the fray, so if there was wounded, we would pick them up and take them to the hospitals. Some memories there that are just seared into my memory, so. But it was we flew sometimes, I think my log shows that one day I flew 13 and a half hours. And for a 19 to 20 year old kid, it was pretty exciting, but also traumatizing in many respects. And I just, towards the end of my first tour, I ended up flying a two-star general. And when he went home, he recommended me to General Abrams. So first tour was kind of combat and not very civilized. And the second tour, I was flying the four-star in charge of the entire war. And it was mostly, it was VIP flying. So.
Yeah. Well, I know your book is specifically about the Pan Am flight, but I'm sure saying that you have these great stories with the 116th Assault Helicopter Company, any stories that you could tell us? Because this audience loves to hear that.
Flying combat in Vietnam was, at first when you get there, you can't believe you're in that situation. And you're scared. But the funny thing is, after you've done it for a few days or a little longer, you can't afford to be scared anymore. You just got to do the job. And we would fly into, in a flight of 9 Hueys with troops on board, we would fly into a landing zone where we would be taking fire. And our guns are shooting back, and you're just hoping they don't hit you or a vital part of the ship. And after a bit, it just gets to be, well, I can't afford to be scared, so I'm just going to do my job. And you have to go, and that's in the book, you have to go to a very dark place in your heart to get through those tours. The savagery and the carnage that you see every day is just, it's overwhelming. So pretty soon you stop letting it in. You just have to close down emotionally. And I think that's where a lot of people who do go to combat, whether it was in Vietnam or our wars today, get PTSD.
Any day in particular that was overwhelming for you?
Several, but they all kind of blend in together. I remember, and this is in the book as well, my very first medevac mission. As it happens, a squad leader got on board my aircraft along with, I think, five troops. And I was what they called tail end Charlie. I was the last flight. As a brand new aircraft commander, they want you, they're not really sure yet how good a pilot you are for formations. So you would fly the last bird in a flight of 9 or a flight of 5, sometimes as Eagle flights. Dropped them off, we're taking fire, and we lift off to leave that landing zone and get a call from the troops on the ground. They've already had somebody that was wounded. And the other thing about tail end Charlie is you are the bird that breaks off for medevacs, because you don't have to leave the flight. You leave the flight, but you're not really part of it as the last ship. And flew back in, and it turns out that squad leader was the one who was wounded and had both of his legs had been blown off. Mm. So, and I remember that and I think this is in the book as well, that we had a hospital, medevac pad, actually a field hospital, only about 20 some miles away. And my first medevac, I thought the only thing important is to get this guy to a hospital. So I pushed it all the way up as fast as the helicopter would go, and actually never even climbed. I kept it low level so I wouldn't waste any time. And the interesting thing about when you drop wounded off, you don't ever know what happened to them after that. So one of the little torments I have when I go to the VA hospital, because I did get cancer from Agent Orange, so the VA took care of that. But one of the little tortures I have is that I'll go to the VA hospital and see guys with in a wheelchair with no legs, and I always wonder if that was somebody that I picked up.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's probably the most significant story. And the book is really about my flight around the world, kind of decompressing after my second tour. But it's really about the healing that I, matter of fact, that's what it's called, the healing Pan American Flight 1.
Yep.
People adopted me, more or less. I think because I was traveling alone. And every country I stopped in, people just kind of brought me into their lives. And I think that's how I started a healing process.
Yeah, and we'll get into that healing process. But I'm wondering, actually, at what point did you realize that you developed Agent Orange? Because for many guys, it's, you know, decades later, and they notice certain symptoms or certain crazy things happen in their lives.
It was, it was 1995, and my stepdad was a brilliant surgeon, and at Thanksgiving dinner, he just noticed that my neck was asymmetrical. There was a swelling, and he wanted to. So he said, after dinner, I want to see you. And he found that the lymph nodes had been were swollen. And even though he had a medical practice and I had medical insurance, he said, go to the VA. I think he suspected that it was Agent Orange. And 1995, I think I went through chemo and radiation, and it has never come back. So I'm a fan of the VA for sure.
I mean, that's amazing to hear.
Yeah, they're good. They really are. They take a lot of grief, and there are some problems that they've had, but for the most part, they're a great organization.
And it sounds like you didn't suffer some of the same consequences as your brothers. I mean, because I do know of people who come back with Agent Orange, and then they have kids, and kids are born with all sorts of disabilities, and that's when they realize that this is what they got.
I'm aware of that. And actually, I tried to do a documentary about Agent Orange in Vietnam, because it's been in their water for years now.
Yeah.
And I read someplace that they have more malformed children than any other country around there. And I believe it's connected to Agent Orange.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a logical connection to make.
It does, yeah. But couldn't get anybody behind that. So I still think it would be an important film to do, but I'm not sure how to make it happen.
Yeah. There's definitely, you know, I think the interest out there in the community, and also people who need to be educated on it. But getting into the book, as you were saying about Pan Am Flight 001, do you want to talk about the flight itself and then get into the healing, as you were saying? I think people would love to hear about that and kind of get a teaser of what it's all about before they pick up the book.
You know, it was a wonderful idea as a business. You could buy a ticket on Pan American Flight 1, and it was good for a year. It was very much like a Eurorail pass. You could leave one country and fly to the next and stay there for as long as you felt like it. And when you felt like moving on, you just wait for the next Pan Am Flight 1 to come through that city and get back on. Like I said, it was like a Eurorail pass for a year, and it went through, I think, about 19 or 20 countries. I know I visited 15 to 16 of them. And again, I think because I was by myself, people would just introduce themselves. Or you'd go to a restaurant in Europe and you can't have the whole table to yourself. If they're busy, maitre d' will introduce you to somebody that also somebody single, and you make a new friend. So it was a wonderful thing to do, to see the planet. And what I didn't realize when I started out on it was that I needed healing. And if you look at war as the absence of humanity, humanity just kind of embraced me. And over that period of 7 or 8 months that I was gone, just welcomed me back to being a human. And I didn't certainly recognize it at first, but that's how. As a matter of fact, that's why the book was written. I have a cousin who's a very successful screenwriter, and he and I were talking one night. He said, "You know, you didn't seem to come back from Vietnam like a lot of guys that he knew that had a lot of baggage." And we were having a good single malt scotch, and we started to talk. And I told him the story of the there was a young girl in Thailand that was selling Coca-Cola, and she wanted to talk about America. And I didn't really want to yet. I felt that I didn't understand what had happened to me, and I wasn't really sure what was happening in America. And but she had to hear about it. She wanted to talk about it. So, and Todd Maddox, my cousin, just said, "My gosh, what else happened?" And I started, I hadn't thought about it as a healing process, but as we started to go through notes that I had taken, it became apparent that I had been more or less pulled back into humanity to heal. The interesting thing about the combat stories, because I wanted this story, the book, to be about healing. But getting into it, I realized I can't really talk about healing unless I show people the savages of war. And as it happens, when I came back and went back to college and got in a creative writing class, and the professor had me write, he said, write what you know about, which after coming back from Vietnam, it was strictly, that's all I did know about.
Yeah.
And I wrote a lot of short stories, never did anything with them, got a good grade in the class, and then just put them away. And when this mission to write this book came up, I thought, well, let's pull them out. Maybe that'll help people understand what it was like and why I needed to heal. So that was really the genesis of that story and why it got written.
So as you said that you didn't really know you were going through a healing process as it was happening, what inspired you to actually take this flight as opposed to going the normal route of just going home in between your tours?
Yes. Actually, if you remember that time, America was at war with itself, very divided, and protests and all of that. And we weren't, as Vietnam soldiers, welcomed back to the country.
Yes.
And I wasn't, because I'd been in touch with guys who had been sent home and, you know, wrote back about what it was like. And I just thought, well, I'm not sure I want to go back there yet. And the other part of it was just an adventure, really. At first, it was this wonderful flight that I could go see the entire planet. And I was, you know, as I left Vietnam, I think I was 21. And I just felt like, let's go see the planet. Between tours, the Army actually bought that first Pan American flight one. And that was for a 30-day leave between tours. So I got on it and went around the entire planet in 30 days. And that, I think, is what led me to believe I should slow down and take the trip again. So very exciting to go some of the... there's a couple of places I wouldn't go again, like Iran and Pakistan. But and I probably, at this point, with the world the way it is, I don't think I'd go by myself ever again.
Yeah.
The world's changed that much, but what an absolute adventure for a kid 21 years old.
Oh, it's
as
gotta
Vietnam
be.
Was.
Yeah. Did it get lonely taking this flight? I mean, I'm a single guy. I live alone. I have taken vacations alone, but it's, you know, a week at a time. I couldn't imagine being alone in the world, nowhere near anyone that you know for that length of time. It's got to be an experience.
Well, it was, but my makeup is such that I don't mind being alone. But the other thing is, I didn't really get a chance to be lonely, because as I said, people just kept, they'd always want to talk to you. And I guess I looked like a soldier. I'm sure my haircut and out-of-date clothes led everybody to believe I was a soldier, and they wanted to know what has been going on. So people just kept prying into my life, and even sitting on a plane, the guy next to you would want to talk to you. And like I said, at the restaurants, you didn't really get a chance, if you were by yourself, to be alone. And then I'd meet people and we'd start talking. And some of these folks that I met, I would hang with them for a few days.
Yeah.
They just kept saying, well, we're going to dinner here somewhere tonight. Why don't you join us? And as you get to know them, I just picked up friends almost everywhere I went. From total stranger to friend, sometimes only took an hour-long dinner. I just didn't get a chance to be lonely, really.
Yeah. Do you still talk to anybody that you met on that flight or that you met during that trip, I should say?
No, I don't. I sometimes didn't even, and this is in the book too, I sometimes don't even remember their names, just the experience. I did, for the film Solemn Promise, interview a gentleman that was at Cam Duc, which was an incredibly fierce battle. Bill Wright, he was awarded the Silver Star for what he did at Cam Duc. And as it happens, one of these people I met on Pan Am Flight 1 was a guy returning from Vietnam who had been wounded at Cam Duc. But that was, those two experiences are like 50 years apart. But Bill is the only one that I talked to from that that battle. One of my very good friends is a guy named Vern Estes, who was my detachment commander when I was flying the four-star. Both four-stars had their own aircraft and their own crews, and Vern was a very senior warrant officer and master aviator, and he ran the detachment. There was only five pilots, two per aircraft and a check pilot, who could come in if somebody was sick. And he and I talk all the time. We've talked ever since we left. We don't very often talk about the war. We talk about the aviation, about flying. And so he's the only one I've kept in touch with from that time.
Got you. So, well, that's Pan Am Flight 001, the book that you have out. And I definitely recommend that people check that out. That's out now. You can get it right on Amazon and pretty much anywhere else, right?
There are, the big ones are Amazon and Barnes & Noble. They both carry the book. And there's about seven or eight others that distribute. I even had one person purchase the book in Sweden. And I that kind of came as a surprise. But so it is available on both of those, Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And it's The Healing Pan American Flight 001.
Yeah. I mean, you never know. There's people who listen to this show, and I look at the statistics all around the world. It's pretty amazing. There's people listening in just about every country. So, but yeah, it's I'm looking at it right here, The Healing Pan American Flight 001, and pick that up, and we'll link to it in the description on softrepradio.com. But next, I want to get into the documentary that you have out, which I was checking out, and that is A Solemn Promise. It's available at storytellerfilms.tv, A Solemn Promise, America's Missing in Action. And before we get into it, do you have any personal experience with guys who went MIA?
Oddly, none whatsoever. In the combat unit, the first tour, if one of our guys went down, we went and picked him up immediately. We never had an MIA while I was with the 116th. when I did the History Channel film, I met a gentleman named Tom Lasser, who was also an Army helicopter pilot over there. And after the film, we got to be friends. We'd meet for lunch once in a while. And one day he said, you know, if you or I had been shot down over there, they'd still be looking for us. And I hadn't thought of it, but the solemn promise that's made to you as someone going into combat is that you will not be left behind. And I started looking at it, and it's an incredibly powerful story. It's also one I think every American should hear about. These days it's a little tough to find things to be truly proud of in this country with all the divisiveness, but this is something that we promised people being sent to combat that we would always come looking for you.
Yeah.
And we do. It's a promise we keep. Now the DPAA, the POWMIA accounting agency, it's a bureaucracy like all of our agencies in this country, and they make mistakes, but the people that I interviewed for that film are devout about their duty, about their obligation to find our missing in action. And when I started researching it and found out that we have over 82,000 MIAs from all the way back to World War II, I couldn't believe the stats, and then I couldn't believe the story, but, so I decided that I was going to do a documentary film telling that story. And shortly after I got into it, I'm not sure how this happened, but a colonel at the Pentagon from Department of Defense called me up one day and says, how come you haven't asked our help for your film? And legend in filmmakers is that it's very difficult to get DOD to help you. So it was quite surprising. And they started feeding me stories once they found out. They vetted me to find out how I would approach this story. And then they started, we've got a family. The agency meets with families of MIAs several times a year to update them. And they said, we've got one of those in, I think it was Oklahoma. Would you like to film it? And so, yes, I did. And then they called up and said, a family of a Korean War MIA is going to, his remains have been found. And if the family okays it, would you like to film the ceremony at Arlington? And they okayed it. Matter of fact, they loved it. And so we went to Arlington and filmed that segment. And it is beautiful. When they find the remains of an MIA, they are given a the entire military honor ceremony. It's just amazing. The caissons, horse-drawn caisson, and the 21-gun salute. It was truly beautiful, and I was very happy to have that, to capture that for the film. And they do an incredibly good job of identifying remains, because it just would be a painful experience to tell a family, we found your son or brother, and then find out it really wasn't them. But it is a very powerful story, and it's something really we as a country should be very proud of, because we're the only country that makes that promise and then keeps it.
Yeah, I heard you say that during the documentary, and I was unaware of that we're the only country that does say that. And then, as you also say, unfortunately, there's still 82,000 remaining that are lost, and a lot of those guys from your era in Vietnam.
You know, actually, less and less with every war. Most of that 82,000 is World War II. But we started off with about, I think it was 2,506 MIAs in Vietnam. And the last number I saw was just over 1,600 that have not still been found. a funny story. I was trying to find people to interview, families to interview with an MIA from World War II. And of course, those are very, very old people now. And my stepdad and mom had a medical practice in a little town called Blythe out on the Arizona River, the Colorado River. And I went out to see my mom and took her out to dinner. And I was so frustrated, I couldn't find anybody that had an MIA from World War II. And my mom says, well, I have a friend whose husband was a pilot, and he was shot down and never found from World War II. My mom and my stepdad were military. They were in the military, and they traveled all over the world. So I'm thinking, well, she's probably got a friend that's in Belgium or something. And she said, well, where's your friend? And she pointed off into a neighborhood and said, well, she lives right in there. And I asked her why she didn't tell me. She said, well, I didn't think anybody would want to talk about it. The interesting thing that happened when I'd find a family to interview, they had been wanting to talk about this for a long time. every one of the families I interviewed, I think there was three or four that made the final cut as interviews, but I talked to a lot of families about it. And it's a story that, an early title for that film was Collateral Damage, America's MIAs. And that came from interviews every term, and they felt like they were collateral damage. In a war.
Yeah. Well, so. A thing that's interesting and you know, really sad about the film is kind of seeing the reactions of these family members, and they're waiting for their family members, and it's a constant wait that just goes on, and you really capture that well.
Thank you. I was amazed at some of the interviews that people would, they'd been carrying this burden with them forever. And they'd talk, try to describe their feelings. And then many, many times they would actually get choked up and break down in the interview, because it was that close to them. They looked for closure for decades. And you can tell that it was still so important, so close to them, because they couldn't get through the interview. We'd have to stop the film and let them recover. it was a fascinating story. I'm glad we did it. It's it is available at the website, but also right now it's at Southern California PBS to see if they want to get involved with the film. So
hopefully they will. It, that seems like an appropriate venue for it, and it's kind of done for that audience. And yeah, if people want to check it out, and I'm sure a lot of this audience will want to, it's storytellerfilms.tv, and the film is A Solemn Promise, America's Missing in Action. And as I mentioned before, you've done quite a few other films looking at the website, Stalin's Voice, A Tale of a City, The Personal Experience, Helicopter Warfare in Vietnam, which is the one that you mentioned that you did for the History Channel, One Last Hit, Crack Cocaine, and the History of Army Aviation. So it's a lot of things, not just military history, but then also a documentary on the drug war. So you have a pretty wide array of subjects that you've tackled.
And right now we're in pre-production on a film on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, because it's an amazing organization. When you watch TV at night, the weather report really is generated by NOAA. No matter how they portray it and talk about it, all this weather information comes from NOAA. It affects our agriculture, our planting, our storms, severe storms, extreme storms. This is the organization that has planes that fly through hurricanes. And they have satellites, planes, and ships all doing research and discovery all over the planet. And they are on they are the point of the spear on climate change. And discovering how that's affecting us and what possibly can be done about it and why it's happening. So originally I approached them to do just a film, just a one-off. And it looks like now it's going to be a 6 to 7 part series.
Wow.
But we are in the very early stages of it.
That'll be great to see. What was the inspiration behind that?
As a pilot and a sailor as well, I've just always known that they were there, that was the original source material for all the weather that we look at all over the planet. And was amazed that nobody knew about it. Or almost nobody knows about it. So I did A Solemn Promise went to Smithsonian Channel. And I got a wonderful email back from the vice president of programming, and she loved the film, but they weren't going to be doing anything military. However, if you're going to be doing something in science, please let us know. So that's where we're going to probably take it first. We are in the pre-production. We're still working out contracts with NOAA, but they are all over it. Friends of mine, filmmakers, said, you know, they're not going to want it. They're a government agency. They really don't care about this, but when I approached them and started talking to them, they were just all over it about telling their story because nobody does know what they do. And their sister agency, NASA, gets all of the press. And, of course, NASA is a lot sexier organization, but
yeah.
NOAA is important to they, you know, one-third of the crops in this country are affected by NOAA's reports. So... And navigation for both ships and planes, they're just about mixed up with everything that we do every day.
Excellent.
So really looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think a lot of this audience will want to check that out. Once again, the website is storytellerfilms.tv. This has been great, and I'm very appreciative of the fact that Mark DiBlanco got us in touch. I'm sorry that Jack was out for this one because I think he'd probably have some good questions as well, but maybe we could follow up at some point. Anything else that you're working on that you want to let us know about?
No, the book and The Voyage of NOAA is currently the working title for that documentary. And there's a couple of smaller projects that I am trying to do, but that is really the focus of Storyteller Films at this point. So,
awesome.
And that's enough, by the way.
Yeah, we'll stay in touch and let us know when that comes about, and we'll have you back on.
Well, thank you, Ian. I appreciate that very much. Been a pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Richard. Great discussion there with Richard Jellerson. Of course, got to let you know, be sure to check out Crate Club. It's a club for men, by men, of gear handpicked by special operations veterans. We have the Dash 1 crate, the Pro Crate, and for those looking for the holy grail of gear subscriptions, our Premium Crate. These are all available at crateclub.us, and right now we are running an extremely limited promotion of 20% off for all Soft Rep Radio listeners. This is the biggest discount we've ever made available, and we don't know how long we can keep this promotion live. So get on it now. That's crateclub.us, coupon code SOFTREP for 20% off any gearbox. Sign up today. Also, as a reminder for those listening, now is the time to sign up for the Spec Ops channel, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a membership for only $4.99 a month. That's specopschannel.com. Sign up today. Last, if you're not already signed up at thenewsrep.com, you've got to get on board. Expert reporting and actionable intelligence from your favorite writers you've heard on here like Jack Murphy, George Hand, Alex Hollings, Joe LaFave, and the many guest writers who pop up as well. Unlimited access to the NewsRep on any device, unlimited access to the app, join the War Room community, invitations to our exclusive events, and it's all ad-free for members. We have a trial offer up right now where you can get 4 weeks for only $1.99. Sign up now at thenewsrep.com. That's thenewsrep.com. By the way, for those not in the know, we have our own SoftRep Radio app that you can download for free on iPhone or Android. Just look that up, SoftRep Radio. And our homepage is softrepradio.com, where you can see our full archive of shows. As always, keep up with us at SoftRep Radio as well. As I said, Jack will be back soon. I have some really big guests on the horizon, which I'm very excited for and that I think you guys will enjoy. As always, you could follow us at Soft Rep Radio. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Ian Scotto. Softrep.radio at softrep.com, where we'll answer your emails. Big thanks to Richard Jellerson for coming on this episode. And we'll be back with a new episode on Friday. Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.